ever wondered what affects the pricing, the coverage, or the availability of the insurances that you buy? My name is Peg Vaghey. I'm the executive manager at Broker Relationships here at CGU. CGU is a proud Australian company. We're owned by IAG, and for over 160 years, we've been insuring Australians and Australian businesses through the insurance products that we supply. We prepare the Strive Report every year. This is our third edition, and we really prepare the Strive Report so that we can coalesce all of the social, environmental, and economic factors that affect the insurances that you buy. Our aim is to make it really easy for you to unpack the reasons why your insurance might change and maybe help you prepare for the conversations that you're going to have with your broker or your insurers if you're coming up for renewal. This is the third edition of our Strive Report, and in this report, we're going to talk about some topical things like AI, claims, how is that affecting claims, and many, many more topics that I hope that you're going to join me for. Sustainability and climate, this is a really big topic. And to help us unpack what that actually means, I've got Kai Montavani here. He's part of the IAG Group Sustainability Projects. And for our listeners, we rely on IAG for a lot of the scale and the intellectual property that's provided to us by our group. So if you hear me talk about IAG and CGU, that we use those terms interchangeably throughout this conversation. Welcome, Kai.
Thanks for having me, Peg.
Now, I think the very first place to start is around ESG. I hear this term thrown around a lot. It's in the news a lot. But can you help me break down what ESG actually means?
Sure. We do hear terms like ESG, sustainability, climate. They all used for the right reasons in within a similar context. But the main difference is it's what they're used for. E includes all things related to climate. So your emissions, your climate risks, climate opportunities. Social, as it stands for, people. So human rights, modern slavery, people, DEI strategies, diversity and inclusion, and so on. The G is for governance. So reporting, mandatory disclosures, frameworks that will help businesses communicate the E and the S.
And so because that's such a big topic for today, we're going to focus on the E and the G. One more thing that I think you've touched upon a little bit, Kai, is around reporting. And in the context of reporting, I hear about scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3. Can you help break that down for us? What does it all mean, scope 1, scope 2, scope 3?
So the scopes are related to your emissions, right? So every business has an emission portfolio inventory. And so scope 1 and scope 2 and scope 3 helps categorize some of those emission sources. But it's pretty simple. Scope 1 is everything to do with the fuels and types of refrigerants, gases that you actually burn as a business to run your business. So think about fleet emissions. So the cars we drive, CGU, salespeople, brokers, or assessors, salespeople, sales teams, they are using cars. And so the emissions associated with the fleet are captured within scope one emissions. The gases, the refrigerants that we burn to actually power our buildings, cooling or heating, are also captured within scope one emissions. Scope two emissions is very straightforward. Anything to do with electricity emissions. So again, the electricity, the energy that we use to power our buildings, our shops, you name it, that's captured within scope 2 emissions. Scope 3 emissions is slightly more complicated. Scope 3 emissions, you've got operational scope 3 emissions. Again, emissions that are associated with how we run our business, however, that we don't have direct control. So for example, travel emissions. We're flying around the country to see customers, brokers, partners, and the emissions associated with flying are captured within scope 3 emissions. However, we have little influence over those. The other part of scope 3 emissions are what we call downstream emissions that are to do with our products and services. So for us as an insurance business, insurance associated with our insurance product are captured in that bucket, as well as, for example, supply chain emissions.
And in that context, because of the Australian Sustainable Reporting Standards that's coming into force on the 1st of January, a lot of companies, especially larger companies, are really at the forefront of trying to understand what the scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions are. But is that, how does that affect a small business? What's your take on it?
We like to say that every small business is part of a large business value chain. So although you may not be captured within the first or the second or even the third stage of this mandatory disclosure requirement, you're still going to be asked by large businesses to disclose or to support the process of a large business disclosing their emissions portfolio. So what the other term that we like to use in the industry is that every business scope 1 and 2 emissions is everyone else or someone else's scope 3 emissions. So again, in our case, IAG, our supply chain emissions, which captures lots of hundreds, if you like, of small businesses, will form our scope 3 emissions. So you may, as a small business, you may get a requirement from an actual customer sales value proposition to say, hey, we're having to disclose this as a large business. We're now going to ask you the same question so we can actually provide the right information to the government, our stakeholders, investors, internally, externally.
Yeah. So how I'm understanding that, Kai, is that for the large companies, group one and that's the phase one, which you referred to earlier, that's happening on the 1st of January, 2025.
Correct. Yep.
And then there's another phase, which is 1st of July, 2026. And then it's happening on the first of the third wave, I think, is happening on the 1st of July, 2027. But you're saying to me right now that don't wait till the 1st of July, 2027 to understand what your scope one, scope two, what your emissions are, full stop.
Correct. Yeah. And the stages are based on the size of the business. It may be revenue size or asset ownership value, employees, and so on. What I would like to say is try to understand and do some research around just simple steps, data requirements. There are lots of tools out there today that are actually designed to help a small business, to facilitate, to plug into the day-to-day softwares that they're already using, for example, accounting softwares. Mm-hmm. So there are solutions right now that can help and facilitate that for small businesses right now.
That's excellent. Is there any links that we can share about that, or can we direct people into particular businesses that can help them do that? And if we can, we'll leave it in our show notes later on.
We can certainly do that.
Yeah. Another thing that I hear about quite a bit is greenwashing and greenhushing, some new words that we all get to know. Yeah. I've seen some companies have their name up in lights in the wrong way around greenwashing and greenhushing.
Yep.
What is the danger there and why does that arise? And maybe tell us as well what the difference is between greenwashing and greenhushing.
Sure. Certainly, more specifically around the greenwashing, and we'll get to the definition, that's keeping board members, directors up at night. And the reason is some of the climate disclosure mandatory framework actually have liability on directors and so on in terms of the actual data that they the companies are disclosing, right? So greenwashing is about that. So greenwashing is about businesses making commitments, making public targets, but not being able to provide enough evidence to substantiate claims. And that comes through in all sorts of different products or marketing at times, or businesses claiming that their products have some sort of sustainability feature, but they don't.
So it's like a misrepresentation effectively of...
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is a big one, and that they have had legal ramifications. So it's about public commitment, a target or a product that you try to frame it as being a sustainable product or service, but you can't really provide enough of superstation. So the regulators are after those businesses, they can't do that. Greenhushing, on the other hand, also to do with public commitments, but it's not necessarily businesses not being able to provide enough evidence. It's just businesses making those commitments today, and in 12 months' time, they work out that they may not be able to deliver on those, and they withdraw the commitment. That sort of behavior has certainly reputational risks, legal risks, but I would like to say that greenwashing is certainly one that is on the regulator's radar right now.
And is that in relation to a company, specifically a company that has a climate action plan, or is that just to do with anything that a company represents up in the public?
Across everything. As right. I've mentioned, it could be as simple as a particular product, a car, for instance, just using a car as an example. That
It's a great example.
That,
yeah.
that manufacturers may be saying that it has a particular emissions profile, but in fact, that is not the case. When you're driving in normal conditions, for instance, the emissions profile is higher than what the car manufacturer is trying to sell to consumers.
Right. Or if you advertise something that you say is sustainable, maybe like washing powder or something.
Correct.
Is that something?
Spot
that,
on. Yeah. Yep. Some other industries such as superannuation funds, for instance, they may have ESG label products, investment products, that they, on the surface, market as being an ESG product, but they don't necessarily meet the actual ESG requirements to be labeled as an ESG product. So there's a misrepresentation on that particular product, which leads people to believe that they are sustainability driven products.
When I listen to all of this, I think it's understandable how a company or an SME might think, oh, I've got so much to do, now I've got to worry about this as well. And obviously they have to, because there are risks and regulations that they need to adhere to in order for them to run their business.
If we take our example, IAG CGU, I think we, being a large business, a lot of the risks are associated with legal frameworks and requirements, such as the disclosure, right? So if we don't meet certain requirements, we could potentially be penalized by the regulator. There's also reputational risks that are associated with expectations from our stakeholders and so on. For example, for us as an insurance company, the transition from internal combustion cars to EVs.
Mm-hmm.
Are we prepared? Are we talking to our customers the right way? That's from a products and services perspective and regulatory framework. For a large business as well as a small business, I would like to say that addressing sustainability, or say climate, so you're basically safeguarding your business. You're moving to electrical vehicles, for instance, being a small or large business, transitioning your fleet, you're going to save money in the long term in the fuel you use, maintenance, and so on. You're moving to more sustainable energy products, for instance, that they have a renewable component of it. Overall, you can actually capture better prices as well. So look at sustainability as how am I making my business more sustainable and competitive in a very competitive environment.
One of our other podcasts was discussing the generational change and how in the next 5 years, there's just going to be more of the Generation Z, the Zoomers, and the Generation Alpha coming in. And what I've read is that they're very interested in a lot of these things, products that are sustainable. And so it seems to me that there's this growing market and appetite for, you know, more sustainable products. So there's probably some opportunities for businesses to be, you know, a little bit more involved in this, for the fact that there's this opportunity sitting out there for them.
100%. Younger generations are a lot more social, environmental conscious, right? We're seeing that right now. So they want to know where their products are coming from, where they sourced. Are they, have they got the right human rights protection in place or environmental impact in place? So certainly that is a shift. And whether you're a small or large business, just thinking about that as an opportunity to target new customer base, that demographic is just a massive opportunity on its own.
Absolutely. And in that relationship, I think, you know, a lot of people, the easiest way I think that people understand this transition is around net zero. So maybe talk to us about net zero as well, and net zero, and what does it mean for Australians specifically?
So Australia, as every other country around the world, we have set targets and commitments under the Paris Agreement, which is an international agreement that lots of countries have signed up for. So from an Australian context perspective, we've got two targets that are very specific. So one, which is being a net zero country by 2050, and we will get to what it means. And another one is to reduce our emissions by 43% by 2030. So two kind of targets, and what we call an interim target and then a 2050 target. Then the next layer, businesses basically have similar targets. So there's alignment between what the country is trying to do with businesses. So IAG, for instance, will have a 2030-2050 target. What does it mean? For Australia, for example, the main contributor to our total emissions comes from our energy resources. So what does it mean to Australia and Australians, us, the UN IPAC? Australia is trying to fast-track its transition to renewable energy. So I'm sure we all have seen that on the news and solar farms and wind farms, you name it. Australia has been leading the world in terms of a distributed renewable energy. So
it's a huge one, yeah.
So
yeah.
Land use, how we're using our natural resources and so on, that's a big one. Obviously, mining sector, industrial sectors. So the net zero commitment, that's 2050, it's basically all those sectors reducing their emissions in the within the scope 1, 2, and 3. So we have absolute zero emissions, and that is absolute terms. So transitioning to low carbon processes, technology, you name it, EV, machinery, input, output, products and services.
And obviously all of this work and all of this regulation and disclosures is really just so we can minimize the impact of climate change and how that affects, you know, the everyday Australia in terms of, you know, the weather patterns and you know, the damage that causes sometimes as they get more severe. Probably as we kind of move into the last part of our chat, I wanted us to talk a little bit about how we're helping, or IAG and CG are helping communities by mitigating some of the impacts of, you know, climate change. I know that there's been a paper recently that we've supported around disaster resilience. Is that something that you can talk to?
We work very closely with our communities, right? So disaster resilience is core to our business. So the way I look at how IAG, CGU best support our communities is basically supporting the transition, right? There's multiple ways. Obviously, from a natural peril disaster perspective, we're right there to help our customers recover and get back on their feet. That's core insurance business. But in my opinion, the best work we can do has been a large asset owner, for example. It's basically helping Australians transition to this net zero target and to a low carbon economy. You're right. It is something that sometimes feels a little bit too far from our day to day. What can we do as individuals, even as a country, if we compare ourselves to other much larger emitters? But Australia has a very important role in the overall transition, being a country that provides natural resources to an export to around the world. So IAG basically helping our communities, helping our stakeholders fast track their transition. Because if we can play that role, going back to the small business context, if we can help our small business value chain transition, so then we further contribute to this bigger picture.
Well, Kai, thank you so much. I've learned a lot. I mean, I'm quite close to this project, but I think through talking to you, you've really helped me simplify quite a bit of my understanding around, you know, ESG and greenwashing, greenhushing, scope 1, 2, and 3. And I think the biggest takeaway that I've gotten out of this is that this is something that we should be encouraging our brokers, our customers to be curious about now and, you know, helping them through kind of some of these items of transition. So thank you so much for spending time with us and sharing your expertise.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Peg.
The STRI report is a ready reckoner for our customers about all things insurance. So if you want to get your hands on the STRI report, contact your broker. And if you don't have a broker, please visit the website for the National Insurance Brokers Association to find a broker near you. From all of us here at CGU, thank you for tuning in, and I look forward to seeing you at the next edition of the STRI report.